Thank you, John. A moment perhaps just to pause and just to bring your attention into your body. It might be, well be when you do that that you notice that you could do with standing and stretching. So why don't we have a mindful stand and stretch, which of course means to slow down, to feel the impulse, to launch straight up, and just to pause. And then just in your own time, to feel your body standing and stretching. Just whenever you're ready, finding your seat. We will have a break mid-morning, just in case anyone's wondering. And in terms of the sense doors that John mentioned, I'm wondering how the hearing portal is doing at the moment. Are we hearing at the back now? Good. So John has beautifully outlined the range of meanings, or some of the meanings in this word, sati, which is translated as mindfulness. And many of you will be familiar with the Buddha's Satipatthana Sutta, which is usually translated, or traditionally translated, as the four foundations of mindfulness, but actually, more accurately, is translated as four ways of establishing mindfulness. And so the Buddha, in this sutta, is directing us to four themes, four aspects of experience, or to put that another way, four ways of looking at our experience, which enable, facilitate the establishing of this liberating mindfulness. Because I think one key reflection to keep in mind, particularly those of us who are teaching mindfulness in secular contexts, is that mindfulness is always for a reason in the Buddhist understanding. It's never just present moment awareness for its own sake. It's inflected towards this process of nibbanaing that John has been speaking about. And, you know, it's interesting to think, well, how might that reflection affect the way I lead a body scan, for instance, in an NHS context or in a business context? Not to say that we would have that, you know, exalted aspiration necessarily, but just that sense of this being liberating, I think, is a valuable understanding just to keep in mind as we lead practices and as we practice them ourselves. Yeah. And these the Satipatthana Sutta outlines these four themes very clearly and lists practices to go with each of them. And as you're probably familiar, the first of these themes is mindfulness of the body. And in a certain way, it is foundational to all four of the Satipatthanas. So whether we're watching body experience or what observing mind states, it's in the body. The body is the arena for all practice. The Buddha said, in this fathom-long body, so sort of six-foot-length body, a bit taller than I am, this fathom-long body can be found, all the teachings can be found, dukkha, the origins of dukkha, and the ending of dukkha. And he also said, and I think it was in the advertising for the day, rather challenging quotation, the people who have no mindfulness of the body have no mindfulness at all. So really, you know, the early suttas couldn't be more explicit about the importance of mindfulness of the body. If you ask Mark Williams what mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is focused on, he says, body, 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 body. You know, and that really, because don't we know just how easy it is to forget the body? How easy it is to forget the body. And there's something about really getting clear that this practice that we're all trying to do, or I'm assuming that if you're here for this day, you're practicing this, is, you know, the body is our main arena for this work. And it's so interesting, isn't it, how the psychology and the neuroscience of the last 15 years seem to endorse the value of cultivating this embodied awareness. And so in the understanding of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, giving attention to the body is the portal into a whole mode of mind. So the work of John Teasdale and Mark Williams and Zindel Siegel, particularly John Teasdale actually, in some of his work with Phil Barnard, really looking at the mind-body in a modal way. So seeing that we could sort of understand that the mind is a bit like a gearbox in a certain way that provides these different modes of operating. So noticing, you know, their key question in creating MBCT was, well, what's going on in depressive relapse? What are the mechanisms that precipitate depressive relapse? And what they found was that when we move into a state of relapse, a whole bunch of different factors change at the same time. So, for instance, attention shifts and often becomes preoccupied with thoughts of the past and with self-images. Thinking patterns change and become ruminative, because we know that rumination is the maintaining activity of depression and of a whole range of, in fact, most of the other mental health difficulties that we can find our way in. I don't know if anybody saw them, but a very interesting study published yesterday on the BBC website, a big study of rumination just showing how sort of foundational or how integral it is to mental distress and disorder. Memory changes. You know, there's a negative memory bias. Perception changes. The way I actually perceive this moment changes. The feeling in the body that it changes. The sense of the body. Neurochemicals change. And so really to see that this is a constellation of different factors that shift at the same time. The Buddha said this 2,600 years ago. But it's, you know, it's really interesting to see how psychology has arrived at a place where it can track these changes and really see the value of understanding the mind in a modal way. And so, as you're probably familiar, actually, just out of interest, who here is teaching secular mindfulness, if we're going to call it that? Yeah. Thank you. And who's training to teach it? Great. And who here has done either an MBSR or an MBCT or one of the other secular mindfulness courses? Right, that's pretty much everybody, one of those. Yeah. And so you know, those who've looked at MBCT, and you know, I know this language was actually originally in John Kabat-Zinn's work in his book, Wherever You Go, There You Are, where he talked about doing mode and being mode, which actually comes more from a Taoist view than from a Buddhist view. Sort of Taoism into Zen is the sort of lineage of that. But in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, they found it really useful just to use those terms. And in the latest version of the Green Book, does everybody know this Green Book? It sounds, yes. Sounds a bit like Sherman Mao, doesn't it? the mindfulness-based, I don't have the greenness of it here, only the blackness of it. The mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression. And the second edition has just come out, and it's really good. They took, I'm not an agent for it, but they took so much care over every word in that book. And before he teaches the mindfulness class, Mark Williams rereads the chapter, you know, just because it's so clarifying for one's intention as a teacher. And there's a great chapter, really almost the sort of central chapter in that book is the chapter on doing and being modes. And in this latest edition, they talk of it in terms of driven doing and mindful being, just to help avoid the sort of misunderstanding that can sometimes happen where people, when they hear the idea of mindfulness as being mode, think that means passivity somehow. You know, or if I'm being mindful, I can't do anything. You know? And we know, as John described in the Satipatthana Sutta, there's a lot of mindfulness and activity, you know. So driven doing and mindful being, just to catch the sort of flavour of those modes, the drivenness of mind, which we know comes from giving the attention predominantly to thinking, to a conceptual processing of this moment, for instance, just in case you've forgotten your body. Yeah, in this moment, you know, conceptual processing of this moment, and that giving attention to conceptual processing involves a range of different qualities as features of this mode. So, a focus on past and future, often an autopilot quality, you know, so that we're in the cinema of the mind, and you know, the body is doing its stuff on autopilot. I find myself at work and wonder how I got here, because I was thinking so much. Yeah. And also the reactivity that both the Buddha and Mark, Zindel and John really identify as the very genesis of our difficulties. So John just now speaking about nibbana-ing as unlearning the habits of reactivity. And we'll say more about this during the day, because it's utterly integral to Buddhist mindfulness and to secular mindfulness, and seeing how when we're focused on conceptual-based processing, that we become more reactive, or we become more prone to reactivity. And also that there's a tendency when we're involved in conceptually experiencing the moment, to treat thoughts as facts. You know, to treat our thoughts as being sort of, we don't question their validity. And that's useful, you know, as Mark sometimes says, you know, if you're going downstairs to the fridge, you don't really want to be asking, is there such a thing as the fridge? You know, and what is the very nature of fridgeness? You know, you're not actually going to question in that way. We need to live to in all sorts of practical ways in a world of facts. However, we all know just how much difficulty that can get us into when we believe our thoughts as facts. You know, Mark Twain, who said, most of the worst events of my life never actually happened. And really to see that this constellation of factors, which in doing mode, which is useful for practical activity, you know, doing mode is activated particularly by what John Teasdale calls discrepancy-based processing. So that perception of a gap between how I think things are and how I think they should be, which is really useful if you need to cut the grass or tidy your desk or make a meal, you know, so that there's a practical... we can see the sort of evolutionary survival role of doing mode. It's a fix-it mode. It's a sense of a problem, and I need to have resources, need to be resourced to get this task done. You know. However, if if I'm perceiving a gap between how I think I am and how I think I should be, or how my life is and how I think it should be, or why that painful event had to happen and what I can do about it, we can see how that discrepancy-based processing leads to the craving that the Buddha identified as the sort of the moment of genesis of suffering, of dukkha. And also because there isn't a practical application of our energies, the attention gets preoccupied by the gap between how things are and how I think they should be, and that is the space in which rumination happens. So that sense that in depressed mind states is a real sense of why did this have to happen? What did I do wrong? What does it say about me that this happened? Those sorts of questions that are so preoccupying, and we can see that, in a certain way, depression, understood from this point of view, as well as anxiety, as well as PTSD and obsessive compulsive disorder and eating disorders, could all be understood in terms of this misapplication of a problem-solving mode of mind. So that the driven doing mode gets activated and tries to solve the problem for us, but it does it by trying to think. And we end up overthinking. And we can see that overthinking is absolutely it's the engine of most mental disorders. And so MBCT finds its way through that diagnosis into the question, well, how can we get out of that gear? How can we get out of that gear? And this is where the three wise men, as they're sometimes called, Mark, Zindel and John, went over to see John Kabat-Zinn and really discovered about his teaching on mindfulness. The powerful, striking way in which MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, is all based on the body. And using the body as a portal into a whole different mode of mind. And so this mindful being mode, which is what's cultivated in MBCT, MBSR, in secular mindfulness, and of course in Buddhist mindfulness, and really seeing how the features of mindful being mode correlate as opposites with the features of driven doing mode. So whereas driven doing mode is conceptually based processing, mindful being mode is embodied, whereas driven doing is past and future, ricocheting between the two. Mindful being is present mode, whereas driven doing is focused on autopilot and habit, writing the stories of our days and life. Mindful being is about coming into the present moment and living more intentionally, being more intentional about where we place our attention. And seeing that enables, rather than reactivity, a responsiveness, a capacity to choose, to feel the impulse, to feel the tug into old patterns of thought and behavior, and to be able to breathe with that and not need to go with that, which is part of the mechanism of equanimity, which is very much the sort of highest mundane mind state in Buddhist practice. And that what that enables is this more metacognitive relationship with thought. So when we're located in the body, when our attention is grounded in the body, it enables us to see thoughts not so much as facts, but as mental events. So there's the planning of that meeting coming and going, or there's the worry about money coming and going, or there's the looking forward to the party at the weekend coming and going. So we start to see these thought patterns arising and passing away within a wider sort of metacognitive, we probably know that word, that sense of, in a sense of space around cognitions, where I can view them from a certain distance. Which right from the earliest days of cognitive therapy, Tim Beck's book in 1979, Cognitive Therapy for Depression, speaks about the importance of metacognition, that distancing from thoughts, But in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, that becomes the central cultivation. That sense of being able to stand back from thoughts, to see thoughts as mental events, or as in the Mindfulness in Schools project, we call them thought buses. You know, what do thoughts do? They come along and want to take us for a ride, don't they? And carry us away. And, you know, part of the practice is learning how to stay at a bus stop at a certain level, to keep a groundedness in the body so that we can allow thoughts to come and go without needing to get on board in terms of where we place our attention. And so, you know, this sense of the body as the portal into a different mode of mind, really, you know, and the portal is accessed by where we place our attention. That really is the unifying paradigm for secular mindfulness. You know, what's so, I think, so interesting or so valuable about this paradigm is that it can, as I say, hold our understanding of a whole range of mental health difficulties, you know, whose characteristic is often overthink. Do you want a question? Yeah, it's very culturally validated, isn't it? Driven doing mode. It's kind of, you know, if you're in mindful being mode, people may think you're not working hard enough, you know, in a certain way, because you don't look stressed. But actually, you know, this discovery that anyone of us who practices mindfulness has, that sometimes to think less, it enables me to think better. Or to give less energy to overthinking, actually enables greater clarity. And we know from the science, and Barbara Fredrickson's written so well about this, how, you know, the narrowing of attention, because one of the other features, you know, we know from the neuroscience, that when we're in, you know, driven doing mode, it's the midline cortical regions of the brain that are activated, so the sort of Mohican bit of the brain, and the amygdala, which is the fight-flight bit of the brain. So people who score some of you will be aware of the mindful awareness and attention scale of Brown and Ryan, which is one of the sort of early measures of mindfulness. And in fact, what it measures is mindlessness. Yeah, and people who score highly on that, so if you have high mindlessness, which are often, you know, high achievers, the amygdala is on sort of pretty much permanently. You know, the amygdala is very, very overactive. So I think I'm having a busy, stressy, sort of creative day. My brain thinks I'm running from a lion, you know. And actually, you know, one can see that what also happens with that is that the attention narrows. When we're stressed, the attention narrows. Again, for very good evolutionary reasons, because it's a mode of mind to do with identifying problems and eliminating them. But we can see, you know, in my stressed moods or depressed moods when the attention is narrow, I'm much less creative. You know, so part of this is in a sense giving this understanding that actually to practice this, to learn how to think less, how to come out of gear so that I'm not planning the meeting at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, actually might mean that I function better. Yeah.
Chris, so, I wanted to ask.
And of course, how do we feed an emotion? Think. So these are not separate, and they're both aspects of the third foundation of mindfulness in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is mindfulness of mind. And of course, as a mindfulness trainer, we need both to resource people to see their thoughts differently, to be able to step back from them, and also to process their emotions more healthily. Which means rather than processing them through rumination, which is what we tend to do, you know, when we're unmindful, we get busy with thinking, actually to process them somatically. So to learn how to drop the attention into the body or to cultivate an embodied awareness, and rather than trying to get rid of the painful emotions, the painful body sensations that co-arise with difficult emotions, learning how to befriend them and to be with them in a very different way, and that turns out to be digestive of difficult emotions in a way that no amount of thinking will be. And I think that's part of our task as mindfulness teachers is to be able to give, you know, that resource an emotional process, separate them. Antonio Damasio, who's done some of the most important work on, the neurologist who's done important work on embodied cognition, really speak, his book is called Descartes' Error, you know, that we can't separate the two. And that I've always found so helpful the Buddha's model, which is one of co-arising. You know, if one looks at the central teaching of dependent origination, which is the Buddha said is, you know, really the heart of his teaching of how our experience is, if you like, generated and created. It's a model of co-arising, where bodily experience and mental experience feed and support each other. So rather than precedence, rather than having to say either the body sensation comes first, and then, you know, it's actually just a model of co-arising. So again, thought and emotion feeding each other. I'm sure John has some reflections on that topic.
Actually, one of the things that becomes very clear when you look at the early texts is that the Buddha has a very, very profound understanding of the relationship between the body and mind. Yeah. For him, body-mind, as I go back to the original way I put it, body-mind are, as Chris put it, you know, dependently arising. There is no such thing, for example, as a mind without body. This is all made very clear. And any of the models that he uses, for example, he's always placing that all of our mental cognitive activities are taking place within a physical frame. And getting close to that physical frame and understanding that is actually, for example, let's take one of the forms of awareness I spoke about, protective awareness. He talks about restraint being established through mindfulness of body. This is why he's saying, for example, that the mindfulness of body is so important, in that kind of competes in the advertising world. He who doesn't have mindfulness of body has no mindfulness. Also, another one he has, he says, he who doesn't have mindfulness of body has no access, and this is a synonym for liberation, has no access to the deathless as well. So everything is coming down to this the embodied mind, the sense of the embodied mind. Interestingly, the title of a book that Sir Francesco Varela actually published quite a number of years ago, back in the mid-90s, again, looking at Buddhist models within particularly Tibetan Buddhist texts in his case, but showing this establishment of the direct, absolute implication of mind-body, not being separate, not being viewed as separate. In fact, we can't even think about them. It's interesting that metaphysical thinking starts to creep back in, though, in the history of Buddhism, and we get the separation occurring. The privileging of one particular dimension, which is the mental over the physical. So much so, I think we always have to have this counterbalance in the Western world to keep on reminding ourselves of our embodiment. And notice the word I'm using, remembering. Mm-hmm. Again, this is mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Remembering that to every, for example, mental state, there's a physical correlate. And often it's far more valuable to be looking at that physical correlate than be trying to solve the mental puzzle.
I'll have a break in a moment. I think that sensitivity, that's part of what we were saying, mindfulness internally and externally. So the Buddha is inviting a mindful sensitivity to the embodied experiences that we see in others. And one of the themes to talk about later on is really how we can find a sense of ground and resource in the body that enables us to meet all the turbulence that we encounter in the relational field, because often we come to the relational field in a not very embodied way, and it's very easy to get overwhelmed. And that's, that's a model of trauma, if you like, and the dissociation that we experience when we have trauma so often. And so really learning how to find a grounded attention that enables a balanced sensitivity in relation to the energies, as you sort of rightly described, that we encounter. Does that meet what you're asking?
Yes, I think so. I guess I have lots more questions.
Yeah. It's a big topic. And, you know, certainly, for instance, the feeling of the feet on the floor or the feeling of sitting on the chair, you know, actually is such a valuable cultivation. I sometimes think, and I don't know what John will think of this interpretation, but the legend of Siddhartha gaining enlightenment, or the person who went on to gain the title of Buddha, gaining enlightenment, it's said that on the night of his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, he was faced with Mara's armies, and Mara is a sort of personification of delusion and obstacle. And Mara, in the legend, threw the whole lot at him, because he could see that he was, you know, coming to enlightenment. And what the Gautama did, because that's actually his name, he touched the earth. And I always find that such a resonant symbol somehow, that means an awful, or can mean an awful lot. And, you know, one way of understanding it psychologically might be that sense of grounding, stability, really feeling the contact with the earth, and just how stable in the, you know, face of the mind's turmoil, or in the face of the energies, you know, coming at us, what is it really to find our feet and to find our seat? And just how valuable, you know, I think if you talk to body psychotherapists, they often say that a lot of us Westerners don't really live in the lower half of the body. And so we feel very overexposed, you know, and very vulnerable, and can easily go into dissociative states. And actually to cultivate that sense of touching the earth can be very grounding and steadying. And I think that's, again, one of the basic practices that we're teaching in secular mindfulness, how to ground and find a sense of contact. Okay, so we just take one more, and then we'll have a break. Yeah.
This is a request,
really. Because we need to be discerning in any moment where to place the attention in the body that supports a sense of balance. And when there's a lot of physical discomfort, the attention, again, for very good evolutionary reasons, tends to go to it and want to get rid of it. And we can become very sort of over-focused on the parts of the body that are often in the torso where discomfort or trauma are held. And that in the face of that, part of the work is to find where in the body can I take the attention that is actually grounding and resourcing and steadying. And certainly in teaching mindfulness to victims of torture and organized violence, I found that a lot of the work was helping them to find a safer place in the body for the attention. So there's a lot of trauma, often in the torso, but a lot of them found the feeling of the feet on the floor, or the touch of their hands on their legs, just to find that toehold back into embodied experience in a way that was resourcing and steadying, actually was a real doorway. And so I think you're absolutely right. We need to be discerning when we say take your attention into the body, because there are many places it can go and many flavours that it can have. And often when there's a lot of pain and trauma, the flavour is very over the break, as they say. Before you launch into the break, let's make this a mindful break. So there's a sense of what that of course means, as it's the theme of today, is to practice embodiment. And the Buddha in this Satipatthana Sutta was very graphic about urinating and the other things that we do. And so just let this be a break that where there's talking, yes, but also we're practicing embodiment and feeling the body doing whatever it's doing. And should we come back at
10:02?
10:02. Okay, thank you. The loser, if you turn the left,